Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Monday, April 8th. This is host Richard Bonulli. Today is actually solar eclipse day here in North America. And we're joined by Chris Wood and Ira Harris. Chris is Global Head of Equity Strategy at Jefferies. He's been named as the best strategist in Asia numerous times by magazines such as Asia Money and Institutional Investor. He publishes a weekly newsletter, Greed and Fear, since 1996. Ira is independent trader, hedge fund manager, global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. This is indeed an honor and a pleasure.
Great. I thought we'd begin, Chris, with your thoughts on the global macro for the economy and the financial markets.
Right. Which particular issue, though? No, but if you're looking from a US, generally. Well, let me tell you, give you my big picture, the way I'm looking at it, because to me, a key watershed in markets was the Federal Reserve move on the onset of the pandemic to basically engage in the biggest monetary expansion we've seen for many years, decades. Because I've had, since the mid 80s, I had a disinflationary view of the world. Because when I started to look at markets, it was just in the brink after Paul Volcker had crunched late 1970s inflation in the US. And we began this very long bull market in treasury bonds. And that I maintained that disinflationary view of the world basically from 1985 to the spring of 2020. I was in Japan in the early 90s, so that obviously further reinforced my disinflationary stroke deflationary view of the world. But then we had the whole QE response to the global financial crisis in 2008, which many people thought at the time would be inflationary. But in my view, that really wasn't going to be inflationary in a CPI sense, but more in an asset price sense, because the money would never went into ordinary people's pockets. So the QE basically drove an asset price inflation cycle. But when I saw the huge monetary expansion with the onset of the US and other G7 countries' response to the pandemic, and I saw the explosion in the M2 chart, and I was taught by a monetarist when I was an undergraduate. Then actually, in my view, the probability then switched that we really were finally going to get inflation as a result of that massive monetary expansion in the US. And since then, in my view, has been that G7 government bonds led by treasury bonds have entered a bear market. So in my view, treasury bonds entered a bear market in the spring of 2020, when you saw that huge monetary expansion, and I believe that treasury bonds remain in a bear market today. And what I said back in spring of 2020, I said fixed income investors should sell all G7 government bonds and invest in local, if they have to own long duration, own government bonds in emerging markets where fiscal and monetary policy has remained much more orthodox. Because in Asia, particularly, which I know about, and other emerging markets, they did not print money in the way the Western world did with the onset of the pandemic. So from an asset class standpoint, from the US, I've been favoring equities over government bonds ever since. And I think that long period where we had negative correlation between government bonds and equities, which created that whole risk parity trade, I think that whole trend has been over with the onset of the pandemic. And the issue right now, given the fact we've had this monetary tightening cycle in the US, is when the monetary tightening cycle is really going to bite. And I think the reason why the impact of monetary tightening has been delayed is the huge base effect, which is reflected bottom up in the excess savings enjoyed by US households as a result of the transfer payments financed by the Fed during the pandemic. So the interesting chart is really that US M2 to nominal GDP ratio has only just come back to trend in the last couple of quarters, whereas back in the spring of 2020, when we had the real monetary explosion, it was 26% above trend. So what I'm basically saying is the lags in monetary tightening are even greater in this cycle than normally because of the unique circumstances of the pandemic.
Very interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I mean, so much of this is what I've done numerous podcasts with Richard, and you know, we've had Mark Faber on, we've had Zuloff, we've had Louis Gavet, you know, so it's been a very, you're a great addition to this. So we've discussed a lot of this, and I have no disagreements with you. I mean, I've been arguing, well, especially as you point out, once Volcker broke the back of inflation, but then, of course, we had the onset of globalization and its forces, and the, as you wrote in your role at the, where you were before, I'll let you mention it, but you guys covered that very well, because the onset of a massive amount of new workers into the global economy basically slayed, in my estimation, and I argued even back in the 70s, the Phillips curve was dead, because there was no wage negotiation pressure. And then, of course, the Berlin Wall fell, and the Germans knew exactly what to do, go east, because there was a massive amount of workers in Eastern Europe with great skills who would be willing to work. And it kept, you know, it's you get to the Hartz IV agreement under Schroeder, well, prompted probably by Kohl, but Schroeder saw it to its fruition, and they crushed the German labor unions. When I say crushed them, meaning there were no wage hikes. They were battling, we'll take zero wage gains, just don't move the jobs. So, but that's over now, especially, and I'm waiting to hear your views. If we're getting into a period of less globalization, will this put upward pressure back? Not that it'll bring, I'm not a fan of the Phillips curve, but it, the role that that played. And now we had Janet Yellen, so this is very topical, in China for 4 days. Lord knows what she was doing there, as she admonished them not to dump products on the market. So that's where we are, in my estimation.
Yes, it seems like Janet, you know, I'm not really on top of the news flow right now of Janet Yellen's visit to China, but it seems like Janet Yellen is, for years it was viewed as very, very, very positive interrelationship between the US and China, where the US, China supplied cheap goods to US consumers, and everybody thought this was great. And it was great in many respects, because US consumers got a lot of cheap goods, and there was this massive increase in wealth in China. So as far as I'm concerned, that was positive. But clearly the current view is very different, and people have woken up to the risk of China sort of dumping goods. So maybe there's some hope to try and, I didn't know what the contents of the visit were, but are the US trying to get China to revalue the RMB? I'm not sure. I'm not sure quite what's going on. But the problem is the US does seem to be trying to engage in a dialogue with China. There was a bit of a truce on the US-China relationship with the visit of President Xi and to San Francisco last November, and the meeting with President Biden, where they kind of did declare a bit of a truce. And I think the whole situation vis-a-vis Taiwan was defused. But the problem with the US sort of trying to engage in China on the whole sort of macro issue of the currency, the problem from a bilateral relationship perspective is, on the other hand, the US has effectively, in my view, declared war, economic war against China, by seeking to deprive China of access to advanced semiconductors. Because this is really squeezing China where it hurts, because given China's demographics, the only way China can escape the middle income trap is to upgrade its economy. And that's very difficult if you've deprived, if you deprived of access to the most advanced semiconductors. So in my view, the brutal reality is that the US has declared economic war against China so long as it's seeking to enforce its policy on semiconductors, which for now, there's no sign of that being relaxed. In fact, they continue to try and strengthen the restrictions.
Richard, if I may?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead, Ira.
So we've also done a couple with Michael Pettis, who I'm sure you're familiar with.
And, yeah, absolutely.
And hold him in such great regard. The greatest compliment is he invited me to come and speak to his class, but that's not happening. But so when you bring up, you know, what do they want to, because that's what I, do they want the Chinese to revalue? Because that's that language. It's almost the language of, if we go back to the 80s, right? With James Baker.
Plaza Accord.
Right? Right, with the Plaza Accord. But if they're looking, to me, the Chinese have a real problem with the weakness of the yen. Because the yen, you know, you've been around in Asia with your footprints in a lot of places. And to me, I look at the Japanese, and yeah, Japan has its problems, although we now have the Nikkei back to where we saw it in 1989, 1990. But the yen, and that's because Japan corporate profits are huge. Even with the amount of money they make overseas that they repatriate, they're not even repatriating it now, which is why the yen stays here. But for me, the Chinese, just like they did in 1998, see the weak yen as a problem. And that the United States ought to be talking a little bit. Well, I know Kishida's coming this week. So, you know, but did they lay the groundwork? Because the Bank of Japan with the Ministry of Finance has kept this yen weak. You can tell me they're fighting deflation. I'm not buying it. That battle is run, and I can look at the equity market. And if they don't do something about the weak yen, and it's the weak yen propel that maybe, I'm not sure, maybe help propel the Nikkei, of course, or the Japanese equity markets.
Definitely.
They're going to wind up with the same problem. Because when they do have to raise rates for some reason, the Nikkei's going to implode and you're going to wind up back in some type of deflationary spiral. So they'd be better off lifting the yen now and taking some of the air out of the Japanese equity market, and it would help the Chinese and maybe get them to put a little upward pressure on the yuan. But as long as the yen remains weak, there is no way the Chinese are going to weaken the currency.
No, they're not going to weaken the currency. Absolutely not.
Yeah, I mean, strengthen the currency. I'm sorry. Thank you.
No, I think the Chinese preferred posture is just to keep the currency in the current trading range, because they're tracking the trade weighted basket, of which the euro and yen are big parts. But the Chinese may suspect that there's some, you know, they'll be wondering, is there some sort of bilateral deal going on between the U.S. and China to put pressure on? Sorry, the U.S. and Japan to put pressure on China. So even if there isn't, people will suspect that.
Yeah, good point. Very good point.
But my simple point is, if you're trying to establish some sort of mutual agreement between US and China on these macro issues, similar to what was agreed between US and Washington and Tokyo in the Plaza Accord, there's a fundamental difference. Back in the 80s, while a lot of people in America thought wrongly that Japan was about to take over, you know, become the next, you know, was a threat to U.S. economic primacy. The fact is that while there were those anti-Japan concerns in the U.S., at the time, Japan and the U.S. were allies. Japan was a big ally of the U.S. The practical reality is China is not an ally of the U.S. And while they were, you know, they were mutually beneficial partners for many years in the global economic recovery, I mean, it's hard to really under-exaggerate how aggressive this policy of the U.S. is as regards semiconductors. So the view from Beijing will be very simply that the U.S. has declared economic war against China. So that, I think, reduces the ability to negotiate or come up with big, big plaza agreement-like deals.
And as we speak, there's a delegation of some business CEOs with the German Chancellor on their way to China. Do you think that, you know, or how do you think this will play out for Europe? Are they aligning more with China versus the?
No, well, that I think just because
U.S.
Well, there's a well, I think people are trying to declare a bit of a truce. There's huge investments by both US and European business in China. So clearly they don't want to, they don't want all those investments to go to zero. The Chinese are pragmatic. The Chinese want to encourage people to continue to invest in China. The Chinese have not taken aggressive moves against US and European multinationals operating in China. They've been very pragmatic. So you've had these aggressive moves on the semiconductors, and you really haven't had retaliation from China because the Chinese are practical. The retaliation would be would be counterproductive. But the problem is the lobbying power of US and European business, particularly US business in Washington, is very limited because the only thing there's consensus about in Washington in terms of the Democrats and the Republicans is this anti-China policy. So if you're a big, you know, if you're General Motors or if you're Nike or if you're Apple or you're JP Morgan, all these companies have huge investments in China, your ability to lobby against these very aggressive political mood against China and Washington has been massively reduced, if not completely eliminated, in the last several years.
Yeah, very interesting. And if we continue on the currency discussion, you mentioned a couple months ago on another podcast that you thought the Federal Reserve would prioritize employment mandate versus the inflation mandate. What are your thoughts there? Do you see inflation going higher than expected, implying a negative for the US dollar?
No, my view is just very simple. If the Fed's got two mandates, and so in my view, if the labor market, you know, showed any real sense evidence of weakening here, the Fed would prioritize the employment market over the inflation issue, most particularly in a presidential, in fact, in any year, but most particularly in a presidential election year. Personally, my guess is that the Fed would almost welcome some weakening in the US labor market right now, because that would give them an excuse to commence monetary easing in the June or July FOMC meetings, which is when the markets have been hoping for the commencement of monetary easing, because that would be good timing vis-a-vis the US presidential election cycle. So I would say if the labor market does not weaken, that makes life more difficult for the Fed, because clearly inflation, goods inflation came down sharply over the last several months, but service sector inflation is sticky. And while I believe if left to itself, I think inflation will come down more by year end, the reality is it's likely to be sticky in the short term. So if the labor market does not weaken, then the Fed's got a difficult decision to make, because the market's assuming rate cuts, and rate cuts may not happen. And then if the labor market starts weakening nearer the election, then it becomes more difficult for the Fed to start cutting rates in the sort of September, October timeframe. The Fed can cut rates then, but obviously the Republican opposition is going to accuse the Fed of being, then the whole thing will become very political.
Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, Ira, on the dynamics and
I'm glad we went there, because when I looked at, and it really bothered me on Friday with the release of the unemployment data, because the numbers were much better than anticipated.
Absolutely.
Except for one aspect of it, and not that Black American unemployment went up 0.8%. And female, Black females unemployment went up 1.1%. Now, being that we're the majority of the jobs were created, government jobs and education and
healthcare.
Healthcare and leisure and hospitality. How were those jobs lost and those numbers so good? And as some people, not directly, but inadvertently pointed out, are the quote unquote immigrants that are entering the country illegally now being flushed into the workforce and replacing some of these jobs? And if that's so, now we have a whole different discussion to take place, especially at the Fed, because I think the FOMC, Chris, have four labor economists sitting as governors. I'm not even talking about Austin Goolsbee, Mary Daly, but there are four FOMC governors who always vote who are labor economists and have done a lot of their research on minority employment situation. I want to know why there was no noise about this in the discussion that followed, because that I did verify that those numbers were right and nobody raised.
Oh, that's very interesting. So how do the immigrants work into that then?
I'm not sure. Everybody's guessing about whether they're being counted. I read a piece this morning. Everybody's got a different spin on it, that they're being brought in and that they're being allowed to work because some of them have gotten these permits that allow them to work. I don't know those numbers, but it did jump out at me with those better jobs numbers, especially in the three areas that were the big growers, that black unemployment rose so dramatically. And this is a Fed under Powell during COVID who was quick to remind us that we will not raise rates until everybody who lost a job through no fault of their own would have a job. You know, so I deemed him in my blog, I call him the Minister of Social Justice. He's not the Fed chair anymore. He became the minister. So why did this go by the wayside so quickly? It's something that really bothered me in the data.
Oh, that's extremely interesting. What's been slightly strange about the labor market is the SMEs employ most SMEs employing a few hundred people employ most Americans, and the SMEs the cost of their borrowing will have risen dramatically. I think the small business survey shows most SMEs are borrowing paying 9 to 10% to borrow. They can't issue bonds, so they can't lock in rates. So it's sort of interesting how resilient the labor market's been given the rise of big cost in borrowing for the SMEs. But my problem is I don't have any aggregate data on how much SMEs are borrowing. But I also think there's something else going on in the US labor market, which is unique to this cycle, that it was very hard for SMEs to get people to work coming out of the pandemic because of the transfer payments. So there's probably a quite entrenched psychology of hoarding labor in the US. So so long as that psychology persists, the labor market may remain more resilient. But if the labor hoarding psychology suddenly ends, you could get a sudden weakening in the labor market. But there's no doubt last Friday's data was much better than market was expecting. But there's also no doubt that if you track it, a large part of the jobs in the last several months have come from government and healthcare.
Yeah.
And the polls suggest that ordinary people don't view it as healthy as what the data suggests, right?
Yeah, you see it in the quits rate, and the jolts. You know, I've read some studies over the last few years, even right at the beginning of the pandemic, maybe a little bit further into it, that the jolts really were not a good measure anymore because they're too stale. That people throw their numbers up on a jobs board. It's electronic. They don't take them down because electronic jobs boards are meant to get as many hits as they possibly can. So whether those jobs exist or not, you have to then go search and find out.
Yeah, I have to say I'm skeptical about the whole labor data. Yeah. So, but what's clear right now is that if you're running the Fed, you would be in a more comfortable situation if the data allowed you to start easing in June, July, simple because of the political cycle. That's just a political reality.
Yeah, even for me, it's getting late, especially because we know, and you know as well as anybody, that as Powell's quick to say, the monetary policy operates with a lag. So it's, again, it'll be just the optics, which is, of course, what most politicians want anyway, is just optics. So that's what they'll achieve. But the stock market's already given them the optics of things are good, right? Even the Democrats point to it.
But if the market suddenly concluded that there'd be no rate cuts this year, there would, by every law of logic, it should cause a bit of a correction in equities.
Yes, but that'll get us to, I'm going to let Richard ask the next question, but it is going to bring us to a question that we have to ask. And that's,
go ahead. Which question? Yeah, go ahead.
The precious metals, gold especially, because everything that we talked about with where rates are at, especially, I've traded gold for 47 years, foreign currencies, and real yields on overnight money were always the harbinger of bad things for metals. And this gold market looks at those overnight real yields, or what the academics like to call R star, and looks at it and laughs. So there's something taking place in this market. And I'm wondering
this gold move is very interesting. So last year, gold was very resilient because I have to admit, Mr. Powell raised rates more than I or most people would have expected 2 years ago. So that's a fact. But gold was very resilient last year during the Fed rate hike. So the correlation between gold and US real rates, whether you're measuring real rates based on Fed funds or 10-year yield, basically broke down. But to me, the most simple explanation for that was that we saw a big pickup in central banks globally, purchases of gold, which basically coincided more or less with the decision to freeze Russia's foreign exchange reserves with the outbreak of this Ukraine issue, or this Ukraine conflict. So I've been assuming, I think most other people have assuming, that those two are linked. So the central banks outside the G7 world have been genuinely shocked, I think, by this move to freeze Russia's foreign exchange reserves. And therefore, they've just bought more gold and bought fewer US Treasury bonds. But right now, this more recent gold move, while that could still be a part, it is kind of strange that gold's been moving the way it's been moving. Because talking to gold people more focused on the nitty-gritty of the gold market, apparently, we don't see much evidence of premiums being paid for physical gold in terms of gold bars, gold coins. And on the Western world, we see no flows. We see continuing outflows out of gold ETFs. And in the case of the gold mining stocks, while they're going up, they're barely outperforming gold, whereas historically, they should be massively outperforming. So all the anecdotal evidence is the demand for gold is primarily coming from China and from non G7 central banks. But it's very hard to, you know, I'm assuming there's good demand for gold in China, but it's very hard to document that by hard data. In fact, it's almost impossible. So it is kind of weird how gold's behaving. But so I think something's changing, but I'm not quite, I can't.
Some dynamics changing.
Yeah,
so
if we see the 10-year yield, you know, because to me, the equity market in the US is interesting, but the fundamental thing about the US equity market in the last year is that the earnings growth of most of the constituents of the Magnificent Seven has just been way better than the S&P 500 in aggregate. So the market actually has been rational, but it's not been a macro trade. The most important event last year in the US stock market was the Microsoft purchase of GB Chat, because that basically was the catalyst for the AI to be the thematic that drove the market. And the most important thing is it gave the biggest sector in the world's biggest stock market, technology, a new story, right? So that was very positive. But the real macro issue is the treasury bond market. So in my view, the treasury bond market is going to retest that 5% level on the 10-year, which then will reactivate concerns about the US fiscal situation. And you wonder if gold's, at least I wonder whether gold's moves related to that.
Your thoughts on that, Ira, for the US?
I agree totally. We talk about that wonderful piece that came out of the St. Louis Fed by Charles Calamaris on fiscal dominance. And we had talked about this, you know, on this podcast for a couple of years already, what would happen once the interest expense on the U.S. deficit exceeded the defense spending. Well, we're there faster. You know, people laughed when we talked about that as the Fed was starting to raise rates, that this was going to come into play, and that with the massive amount of fiscal stimulus, we're there. And to me, that's where the politics, where the quote unquote, the rubber meets the road, because now you're going to get into discretionary programs, because the cost of funding all of this is just exploding and it's not getting any better. And Yellen thought she was going to play fast and free with it by moving it to the front end. It would give them a little more flexibility, but that's kind of run out of runway too. So she's going to have to make some decisions. But do you have a view on fiscal dominance?
Yeah. Well, what? Yeah. How do you define fiscal? Because obviously, how do you define fiscal dominance?
I'll give you a column. It's so important. I keep the paper. So I'm going to give you his definition.
Please.
Fiscal dominance refers to the possibility that the accumulation of government debt and continuing government deficits can produce increases in inflation that dominate central bank intentions to keep inflation low.
Yeah, see, I'm not clear quite what that means. From a hard line, not that I'm a hard line monetarist, but a hard line monetarist would just obviously totally refute that, right?
Well,
but I think a more practical way, I think, of saying this is if the treasury, the key issue is the treasury, because basically government bond yields should track nominal GDP growth, right?
Yes. Historically. Yes.
Now, but if supply concerns have started to enter the U.S. Treasury bond market, then that's what I think people call the term premium. That can lead to a situation where the Treasury bond market can go, can start to, decouple from nominal GDP growth trends because of these supply concerns. So to me, if the supply concerns are driving the Treasury bond market, I suppose that's what they call fiscal dominance, right? Because then the Fed has to react to that.
Or not react.
Yeah, or not react. Yeah. So, but the other reason why the Fed will not want to keep tightening beyond the employment and the inflation standpoint is obviously the bond market. And actually, to be fair to the Fed chairman, he has made some comments of late that the fiscal situation is not sustainable. But this is a very important big picture issue. So, to me, the key simple question is, is this issue of fiscal dominance is one way of looking at it. I look at it another way. Will G7 government bonds, starting with the US Treasury bond market, continue to be viewed as risk-free? Now, for years, everybody's viewed, in fact, the whole post-2008 regulation of the global bank financial system, G7 banks, is based on the premise that G7 government bonds, and particularly US Treasury bonds, are risk-free.
Yeah.
But nobody believes that emerging market government bonds are risk-free. So if you're a finance minister of Indonesia or India or Brazil or Mexico, you basically, your view is that you have to basically pursue a certain, relatively orthodox monetary fiscal policies, or people won't buy your bonds. That's how the people in these countries think. I know, I've talked to them. I'll give you the example of Indonesia, because if you look at a chart of Indonesia the last several years, the 10-year rupiah government bond yield has dramatically outperformed the US 10-year treasury bond. Indonesia has a self-enforced 2% fiscal deficit limit. That's entirely self-enforced. But they don't think their government bonds are risk-free. So I look at these G7 countries led by the US Treasury bond market as basically the equivalent of entitled trust fund kids. They think their government bonds are risk-free. But this is simply based on a convention. And what's so interesting about the outperformance of local currency emerging market government bonds since the pandemic, and outperformance, by the way, in US dollar terms at a period where the dollar's strong, is it's beginning to suggest that the market's beginning to look at this issue. So that's the way I'm looking, but it amounts to the same thing as fiscal dominance.
Yes, and I'm glad we're talking about this. So yeah, right. So we get the zero risk weighting, which was critical, of course, to the ECB's bailing out of the so-called pigs. During the bond crisis, the sovereign debt crisis in Europe. So that was very important. And it was also important to the United States. And of course, Germany with its Schwarzschnell, which is its zero, you know, its black zero, which is to keep that deficit. They're in better, if they needed to enhance their spending, they could do it, except that they're responsible, of course, covering all of Europe, because without the German credit card, you could take the ECB and the whole EU project and say...
Well, the problem there is that, the problem there in Europe is that the real fault line in the Eurozone now, in my view, is German politics. So actually, the former so-called pigs, what I've been saying in the last few years is the place you want to own in Europe is Southern Europe, Italy, right. Spain. One, because they got marked to market, but two, because Brussels been giving the EU recovery funds. This money's been transferred in the form of loans and grants to Southern Europe, which is the amounts they're receiving are material to GDP. The best example is Greece, which is the best run, the best government in the Eurozone right now.
Right.
But the Germans are basically, the German establishment is committed to this, this project to move incrementally towards fiscal union, which you can see, but in the form of this EU recovery fund. But ultimately, you're seeing growing evidence of a political backlash against this. There's even now a movement in Germany called Dexit, which is the German equivalent of Brexit.
Yeah.
The critics of this describe the EU moves to fiscal union as a transfer union. So I think pressures are growing in the Eurozone on that front. But the key fault line will be German politics.
Well, I'm glad we kind of bled into this. Sorry, Richard. So after the Schwarzschnell, but and I agree with you totally on Greece, but what did Greece have to go through? An internal devaluation, and they ran primary surpluses, but they also had the help of Lagarde running the IMF, who stepped in, but they did what needed to be done. That's not doable, Nina. It's not doable in the US. The US could not do it.
Yeah, the Greeks took a lot of pain. They got marked to market, and I spent some time in Greece in the last few years, and basically they got a lesson that there's no such thing as a free lunch. So they really did get marked to market, and they've also had actually they've had a good government. Yeah. So personally, I would rather own Italian bonds or Greek bonds than German bonds. I instituted a long-term short of the 10-year bond when it had a negative yield.
It's a brilliant point. And you see right now, the 10-year Italian has contracted in. It was in to 130 basis points last week.
Yeah, that's right. And the reason the periphery spread is so narrow is not because, it's partly because Italy's doing well, but the real reason is Germany is no longer, Germany's a suspect credit. Germany's facing deindustrialization. This is not, so the real problem, the crisis economy in Europe right now is Germany. It's literally facing deindustrialization.
Interesting too, because at the March 7th ECB, we'll get a meeting this week. But at the last meeting, Lagarde threw out it wasn't an answer to any question, but she used it as an answer, a capital markets union. Well, if they can create, and I think that's why Lagarde is there for her political acumen, certainly not for her economic acumen, but she's a good politician. She's a strong politician.
Absolutely.
If she could get that capital markets union done, because then we'd finally be on the cusp of a euro bond. Of course, it would take great capitulation from the Germans. But here we have a meeting this Thursday. I want to see if she picks up further on that. It led me to, believe it or not, and I know your hair will stand up when I tell you this, that it led me to buy for the first time. I've been buying European financial assets. thinking that she's going to accomplish this, because then places like Commerce Bank and Deutsche Bank become interesting. If you got a euro bond market, you would get a broker dealer system, which Europe has never had. So
no, European bank stocks, there's a lot worse places to invest in these European banks. They were very cheap. The key positive in the last year is that they got out of negative rates.
Right.
Obviously, state the obvious, negative rates were an insane policy, because if a monetary policy is negative for your banks, which negative rates clearly are, why on earth would you have negative rates? So this has been a phenomenal liberation for the banks, and they were very cheap. And Europe's on a de facto, ever since Mario Draghi broke the original founding rules of the euro,
yeah,
and agreed to buy Italian government bonds, which is against all the founding principles of the euro, but Mrs. Merkel decided to turn a blind eye. We've been on a de facto road to fiscal union.
Yes, I mean, these are absolutely such great points. Right. When he said no taboos, there'll be no taboos. And anything was due, right? We'll do whatever it takes. And
so we're on the path to fiscal union, and that both the current German establishment is still in favor of that. But what I'm saying is the risk to them, that's a direction of travel as of today. And that's why the periphery spreads are going down. But all I'm saying is the fault line is a German politics.
Yeah, I agree with you. And people don't
That's not a next 3 months story, but that will become a story the next German federal election, which I think is next year.
Yeah, and you can hear the drumbeat. You're 100% right.
Yeah.
People aren't listening because they think, well, the AFD will disappear. They're not going to disappear. They keep growing AFD, in stature.
AFD are polling around 20%. And I think you can assume, I shouldn't say you can assume, but I think the likelihood is that the polls underestimate the AFD support, because people probably may not want it, particularly in Germany, given the history, want to say they support the AFD. But the CDU, the traditional conservative parties, have become moved so far to the left that they've left the traditional conservative political space wide open for the AFD. And what I'm hearing is now even a movement to try and ban the AFD.
Yeah. So
any move to try and ban the AFD is likely to backfire to increase the AFD support. Yep. That's an issue that will come more into focus. Yep.
So when we return, because we see the issues with sovereign bond markets, and you're right, the emerging markets are much better. I almost call them less LDCs, or I'm not sure what the word is, but the emerging markets, Mexico, Brazil, these bonds, China, they've been much better performers, and you've been right to own them there. Now, if the Fed would actually, or the Treasury would let the markets work, I would say what they all need to get to that area of fiscal dominance would be a failed auction on a 10-year or a 30-year note. Because that would be the wake-up call that they all need, but of course they won't allow it.
Because isn't the more and more the issuance is at the short end, right?
Yeah, because Madam Yellen was very good. I think it'll come down to haunt her in huge numbers by moving so much to the front. And then you had, of course, the comments from Waller six weeks ago, when he thought it would be a better idea if the Fed balance sheet would become 35% in the short end and it would get rid of the MBS. Interesting.
Now this is all, I mean, this potentially is, yes, it's all, obviously you can get away this for a long time, but at some point there's a reaction. So the interesting question, which I don't know the answer to, is the move of gold reflecting the concerns about this, or is it just a coincidence?
Yeah, but it's a currency. People want to make it it's not a war. It's the gold is telling you something. We just don't know what to be, by old standards and old measures. It's doing something. And that's what's kept me long, is because when something is doing something that it ought not to do, I've traded long enough to understand, pay attention. There's something going on that is changing. Now it could change again tomorrow, but every day we see, even gold they tried to break it hard today. It comes back again today. And yet interest rates are even higher today. So,
yeah. So to me, I mean, to my firm view is between asset classes, equities are preferred over bonds. And if you have to have long duration risk, because you know you have to lock in rates, which many institutions of people do, then I think one should own emerging market government bonds, which are not behaving like don't feel entitled. They have to well behave. And if you want to own U.S. or U.S. bonds, it seems to me obvious that it's much better to own the best grade, the best U.S. corporate long-term bonds, which have very solid balance sheets, which have refinanced their debt, locked in yields, then rather than U.S. Treasury bonds. And in a world where you have what you just highlighted, a potential failed auction, you could get a situation where top quality U.S. corporate bonds trade through treasuries, i.e. their yields are lower than treasury.
And on the equities, do you have a still bullish case for India equities?
And then, if you ask me, my view for the last 20 years remains my view today, that for people who want to make long-term investments in equities, the best stock market to invest in for the next 10 years is India. And I would have said the same thing. Yeah, I would have said the same thing before 20 years.
Any other jurisdictions like Indonesia?
No, Indonesia is fine. But if you all these, many of these major, Indonesia, Brazil, Mexico, they've all got good stories. But India, from an equity standpoint, India is the standout because it's a big domestic demand story. It's got positive demographics and it's got amazing entrepreneurs. And under Modi, Modi's controversial for many reasons, but from an economic standpoint, I can tell you Modi's instituted some amazing reforms, which are beginning to show up.
Yeah. And also in terms of other commodities like oil and gas, what are your thoughts on trends there, given the geopolitical risk?
No, I think portfolios need to have some energy exposure because right now, oil is important. If oil keeps going up here, the last thing the Fed or the Biden administration want to see right now is a $20 rise, further rise in the oil price, because that makes it very hard for the Fed to cut. And in my view, the key issue in oil, if you assume that OPEC Plus will maintain discipline, which for now they are, the key issue is U.S. shale peaking. You know, because it seems like most of the shale areas have peaked except for the Permian. But I would have some energy stocks as a hedge because, and obviously the other point, which the markets are obviously not focusing on because markets are not good at geopolitics, but the reality as of today is that both of these major geopolitical situations, be it the Middle East or Russia, Ukraine, as of today, continue to escalate.
Yeah, that's a good point. Any thoughts on that, Ira?
Listen, I could listen to Chris Wood talk about Asia, especially. The only thing I would throw in, Chris, because I've been playing more into banking, European financials for the last year and a half. Yeah. But I've looked at UBS only because of its master footprint of wealth management in Asia. I thought that was a great growth story.
No, that's true, but. But the best reason to buy that stock was the deal they negotiated with Credit Suisse.
Yeah, I was fortunately buying it long before that because I saw what they were doing in Asia and that the fact that they no longer wanted to mimic Goldman Sachs, which is a failed model for banks.
No, that's all been working. Yeah, but I mean, yeah. I've been saying people to buy the Greek banks. That remains a very good trade. The Italian. Mm-hmm. But I think all European banks are stock specific. In Asia, apart from India, Indonesian banks are a good long-term hold, best net interest margins in Asia.
I've been accumulating Tokyo Mitsubishi only because if the Japanese, and I think the Japanese have a story.
The biggest weighting in my Greed and Fear Japan portfolio by a long way is I'm massively overweight financial stocks in Japan.
Me too, but it's been owning a bond because when interest rates were 0 and 1%, the bank at Tokyo Mitsubishi was paying 4% in dividends. Now it's down to about 2.5. But
yeah, but the finally lifted rates off zero.
Yeah, I know. But what a disaster. And the fact, but I look at, you know, to me, the other bonus, and maybe you'll have a comment on Tokyo Mitsubishi, is that they own 23% of Morgan Stanley. And right. If they ever got their heads together, they might figure out a way to become better adept at being a bigger wealth manager across Asia using the abilities of Morgan Stanley.
Yeah, that's entirely conceivable. But the Japanese financials, so long as you think that normalization of monetary policy is going to still got further to go, Japanese financials are a good hold.
Yeah, they will wear me out, because to me, Yellen should be talking to the Japanese about their currency long before she should get to the Chinese. But that's a story for another day. But yeah. I know, Richard, are you trying to bring this to an end?
Yeah, just a final question on your assessment of maximum fear on investing in China. Do you still feel that way? And from a Western investor perspective, is China investable, like for Hong Kong equity?
It's investable, but Chinese stocks are extremely cheap. There's absolutely no doubts about it. So anybody's about, if you like a stock bottom up in China, Hong Kong, I think you should definitely add to it here. But as of today, there's no, you know, there's no macro catalyst for the Chinese market to suddenly have a huge performance, but apart from the fact that the government has sort of signaled the level where it wants to support the downside. But great. Chinese stocks are extremely cheap. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
I mean, well, Chinese stocks about 8 times, to put a number on it, Chinese stocks were 8-9 times earnings. You know, India's on about 20 times earnings. When I last checked, Indian's mid-caps were on 30 times earnings.
Mm-hmm.
But very, very big ballpark numbers.
Interesting facts, yeah. Yeah, been great observations, insights. Thank you so much, Chris. And any other pointers that you'd like to provide?
I need to check out the fiscal dominance paper.
Okay.
Charles Kalmaris. It's from the St. Louis Fed. I'll give you the date of it. It's it was from 2023 of the St. Louis Fed. Kalmaris, right. C-A-L. I think you'll really enjoy it.
Really arguing is that the fiscal issues will become a constraint on monetary policy, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. One way or another. And nothing would do, it would behoove them to have a failed auction. But of course, they won't allow it because they would worry about the ruptures that would, you know, the negative waves that would float across.
If you were the Fed and you were worried about this, you would, as you say, you'd want that event to trigger political reaction.
Yes, you would, because, you know, again, now we're being dragged into it. We're not forcing our way into the fiscal discussion. It's coming on our watch, and we have to respond to it. It would behoove them, but it won't happen. But let me just say this. This has been an absolute pleasure. Anybody who has a sense of the economist, you're looking at a man who is just, his footprint in the greatest ways was all over it from when I would read it. Literally, my first read, it would come Saturday in the mail, and I would read it. And some of those covers, anybody should go face. When Chris Wood was heavily involved in the Economist, they had the greatest covers of anything. And you can go find them. You should give them for Christmas gifts, frame them, and give them away. They're phenomenal.
So, when did you start reading the Economist? 98, you told me.
1977.
When did you stop reading it?
Oh, 98.
Yeah,
I hadn't even known that you were gone, but then I started seeing you on CLSA.
Yeah, no, I left Economist 94.
Yeah, so you know, I said this magazine has gotten terrible, you know, and then I go, I can't read this anymore. I'm not learning anything, and it was always my go-to read when my kids, if I was taking them to a ball, you know, where they had to go play, and I had to sit in the stands and watch. I had the Economist with me. That was my read. I kid you not, because That was because, again, especially because of the respect that they paid to Schumpeter.
Yeah.
And that was so evident when they named him the greatest economist of the last 100 years. But I would tell people, go search through Google. These are some of the funniest covers. The one, of course, Chris, will always stay in my mind is the two camels on the cover humping to please on the on the oil. One of my favorite ever. Great. This is great.
Great fun.
Thank you so much, Chris. Yeah.
Okay, great for the time.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Thank you. Take care.
Good to see you. Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Bye.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.